Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, listeners. Dana Stevens here. Before we get started, I wanted to let you know that this is the last week to get a great deal on Slate Plus memberships. Right now, you can get 6 months of Slate Plus for just $29, which is 50% off the usual price. As a member, you'll get zero ads on any Slate podcasts, unlimited reading on the Slate site, and member-exclusive episodes and segments from our show and other shows, like Slow Burn and the Political Gabfest. This is your chance to support everything that Slate does, from our written work to our podcast episodes, which I and I think everyone else at Slate do everything we can to make worth your time. So please, if Slate podcasts have become a big part of your listening routine, we ask that you support our work and the work of our colleagues by becoming a member. You can sign up at slate.com/culture plus to access this special deal. Once again, that's 6 months of Slate Plus for just $29. The offer is good through this Friday, October 28th. Thanks.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest Two Severed Thumbs Up edition. It's Wednesday, October 26th, 2022. On today's show, The Banshees of Inisherin is a new movie from writer-director Martin McDonagh. He of Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri. It stars Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson as two friends locked in a mysterious feud. And then Disney, of all people, brings gory horror spectacle to the small screen with Werewolf by Night. It stars Gael Garcia Bernal and Laura Donnelly as monster hunters trapped on a creepy estate. And finally, we discuss an article on Forbes.com whose headline, I think, speaks for itself. Maybe Gen Z have canceled the thumbs up emoji, and here's why you should worry. Joining me today is Julia Turner, the extremely brow-furrowed Julia Turner, emoji slinger extraordinaire. Julia, of course, is the deputy managing editor of the LA Times. Hey, Julia.
Hello.
And of course, Dana Stevens is the film critic for Slate.com. Hey, Dana.
Hey.
Should we make a show?
Let's do it.
All right. Well, Parak and Colum, if I'm pronouncing those correctly, meet every day at the local pub on their home island of Inisherin to share a pint and a laugh. But right at the outset of Martin McDonagh's new film, Colum tells Parak baldly, without explanation or apology of any kind, they will not be on speaking terms going forward. Colum is in his 60s, a fiddler who lives alone with his beloved dog. Parak is about 20 years his junior, an easygoing and unambitious man who's very much at home in this tiny world. He's brokenhearted, as he would be, by the mysterious loss of his one really close friend. But as he persists in pursuing his affection, Colum vows he will cut off a finger for each attempted reconciliation. What follows is a strange mix of a, you could argue, light-hearted comedy and tone occasionally, and an Old Testament allegory about the intractable darkness of the human heart. The movie stars Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson. It's written and directed by Martin McDonagh. Okay, in the clip we're about to hear, Parak fatefully breaks their silence and demands an explanation. Let's listen up.
Now, if I've done something to you, just tell me what I've done to you. And if I've said something to you, maybe I said something when I was drunk and I've forgotten it, but I don't think I said something when I was drunk and I've forgotten it. But if I did, then tell me what it was. And I'll say sorry for that too, Colin. With all my heart, I'll say sorry. Just stop running away from me like some fool of a moody schoolchild.
But you didn't say anything to me. And you didn't do anything to me.
Well, that's what I was thinking, like.
I just don't like you no more.
You do like me.
I don't.
You liked me yesterday.
Oh, did I? Yeah.
I thought you did.
So, Dana, you know, this is an extraordinary two-hander, of course. Two terrific performances are at the heart of it. But I think there's someplace else to set it up. It's very much a movie about a place and a time, very specific place and a time. The place is this somewhat brutal and lonely little island outpost. And the time is 1923, as civil war is raging audibly on the mainland. Maybe talk a little bit about that as it contains all of the, you know, rather remarkable things that happen in the course of its plot.
Yeah, I mean, I will start out by saying that I was jumping up and down for us to do this after seeing it and writing on it last week. It's just great. I really, really encourage people to see this movie, even if you aren't already a freestanding Martin McDonagh fan. There's going to be a certain built-in audience for this movie, which is people that already loved In Bruges, which is a movie from, I don't know, over a decade ago that was also written and directed by Martin McDonagh with these two guys in the lead. You know, a little bit of a similar sort of Laurel and Hardy vibe between them, although they play people whose friendship is becoming more intimate in that one instead of less intimate in this story. But outside of, you know, folks who are going to flock there just because those three names are connected with it, I really hope people will give this movie a try because it's just not like anything else I've seen in a long time. So, yes, it is true that this movie is set in a very specific historical time and place, though it takes a little while to figure that out because Inisherin, this fictional island where they're living, is so remote and so, I'm going to say countrified that we could be in almost any century, much less decade. But we do start to realize via various signs like horse and carriages going around on the island, although presumably cars did exist in 1923, or like you say, the sound and sometimes the sight of explosions from the other side of the island, from the other side of the bay, that is, the mainland of Ireland, where this civil war is going on. But what I really, really appreciate about The Banshees of Inisherin is that it doesn't reduce its meaning and its purpose to, you know, being an allegory for that war or for war in general. It doesn't seem in many moments to be trying to make a bunch of points or sort of score any kind of message cred with the audience. And to me, that makes it so much more profound. Samuel Beckett is someone who has been mentioned, of course, also an Irish playwright like McDonagh, who's been mentioned in connection with the vibe of this movie, right? It's sort of existentially bleak, but also funny in the way Beckett could be very funny. And, you know, it's about big questions, really big questions, like the purpose and meaning of life and friendship. But it has this playful and sometimes cruel tone to it. It's about cruelty in some ways, but it isn't cruel toward the audience. And that, I think, sets it apart from some Martin McDonagh movies. You might remember him as the director of Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, which, while accomplished in many ways and certainly original, I think turned a lot of people off because of, you know, its cruelty toward its characters and its kind of darkness about the future of humanity. This movie has kind of warm and cold currents flowing simultaneously. And I love the way it manages those tones. I also think Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson have never been better. I don't know. I mean, I'm just jumping up and down repeatedly. So I'll stop and hand it off to the two of you. But I didn't expect to love this movie as much as I did. And just hearing that little snippet from it made me want to watch it again because it has my heart.
Julia, what about you?
I love this movie. And I was surprised by how much I love this movie because of how much I disliked Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, which I remember having the exact opposite qualities of that, of this movie. I remember that movie feeling sort of like strident and exploitative and, you know, dim about American politics and class in ways that were perhaps understandable, but also just manipulative and like I really, really didn't like that movie. And then In Bruges, I think we might have talked about In Bruges in our like first week of existence on the show or month. You know, and I remember it sort of as a textured caper. And I found this to be kind of profound and beautiful in the exact opposite quality of not really directing you to draw too much of a conclusion. I mean, my heart and sympathies were very much with the rejected friend, and Colin Farrell the linearity of his eyebrows. Like, if you could just give an Oscar to eyebrows for this performance, like, his eyebrows, they're like caterpillars on speed, but slow, but they just are so expressive and mobile. And both performances are wonderful. And the performance of Carrie Conlon as Porig's sister, Siobhan, is amazing too. And I just adored it. Steve, are you team Colm or team Porik?
I should start by saying I'm not team Martin McDonagh. I don't like his work almost uniformly. And I thought Three Billboards was a train wreck in the kind of mawkish race parable, class parable way by someone who didn't understand, as you say, Julia, either American race, class, culture, folkways, speech, none of it. And I think this is a return to form in the sense that it's a very familiar territory. His early plays, which made him a star on Broadway, were all set in very similar world. And I thought there was a courage to this movie that you don't, he does give his younger friend a reason in this movie in a way, which is actually one of my least favorite scenes in the whole film. He says essentially, for some unexplained reason, he believes he has about 12 years to live. And he's come to this revelation in his life that he's wasting them. And he wants to compose his simple fiddle tunes, devote himself more singularly to music, and at least pay a kind of homage to those people who left something lasting and meaningful of themselves behind. And he sees, you know, his life dwindling away in a pub with this faffer who sits, like, it's an English word, probably not an Irish word, this, you know, layabout, this happy layabout. And he just needs, it's a movie about amputation in one very literal sense, the cutting off of the fingers, which is vivid and really horrible. And it just makes embodied in the bloodiest way what's happening between them. It's really a movie about amputating yourself from what community you have. And in that sense, Dana, it's an absolutely pitiless homage to just the intractable perversity of the heart, right? Like, it refuses the very modern temptation to say, here's why he's doing this. It is just a singular act of perversity. But, and the one thing, I mean, in addition to the performances, the one thing I have to give McDonagh as a director, he seems to have come, I mean, he's made huge leaps as a film director. And the atmosphere of this movie is so pervasive. You are so deep inside this world. And visually, it's actually in some ways a modest film, but in other ways, it's an absolutely stunning, you know, ode to a very specific looking and feeling place.
Yeah, I think you're right that in terms of craft, this is the best film Martin McDonagh has made. I mean, it definitely is also true that he is more at home in Ireland and in the UK than in America. You know, he made another movie besides Three Billboards about the US that's kind of like a crime caper called Seven Psychopaths that also doesn't work at all. And I think it doesn't manage to pull off that dark tone without leaving a bad, sour taste in your mouth. This movie not only balances that tone perfectly, but we haven't really talked about this. It looks incredible. The cinematography is beautiful and very well considered, establishes that sense of place very simply, but very effectively. The music by Carter Burwell is this great kind of fairy tale soundtrack that's full of these little glockenspiel tingly sounds and just things that take you into this somewhat, you know, Celtic folklore almost kind of world. It's, I don't know. I mean, I think this movie is profoundly accomplished at what it sets out to do. And that may not be up your alley because it is not quite psychologically realist. You know, you have to accept as not quite an allegory, but something as of a fairy tale, what's happening in this community and between these two men. But I feel like once you do accept this movie at its own terms, which it lays out pretty well, it accomplishes all of that kind of perfectly. I also wanted to shout out some of the smaller performances because Martin McDonagh, as a former playwright, has almost a kind of a company that he works with. He really likes to work with the same actors as, you know, the two leads here over and over. And Carrie Condon, who plays the sister, the bookish sister of the Colin Farrell character, who is miserable on the island because everyone on the island is boring, as she points out at one point when, you know, her brother's friend complains, well, he's feckin' boring. She says, you know, you're all feckin' boring. And the island is just too small to contain her. She's a great character, wonderfully played by Carrie Condon. Also, Barry Keoghan, I don't know if you guys agreed, but there's something really, talk about Shakespearean. He's almost like a Puck or some kind of holy fool figure. Barry Keoghan, who unfortunately people may know more from, you know, the fact that he's now in Marvel movies, but he's just this fantastic Irish actor who's just beautiful in a small role as the kind of village idiot of the small island. All I do when you keep bouncing back to me, Steve, is just raving more about this movie. And maybe that's just because I enjoy being surprised. I like going into a movie thinking, Martin McDonagh, he's done some good stuff, done some bad stuff, wonder how this will be, and then just feeling transported and entranced for 2 hours. It's a rare thing.
I mean, I hear what both of you are saying. I guess I feel like I want to get to the meat of this, which is, I was serious. Are you team? Do you find yourself siding with one of the fellas, or do you find yourself sympathetic to both of them? And why is this particular question of whether it's acceptable to end a friendship in a cloistered world where you don't have very many options for friends? Why does that seem so cruel? Is it cruel? Is it acceptable? Like, I think there's just like moral questions at the heart of the movie that I'm curious to hear you guys, your responses to, because they very much colored. I found the moral conundrum. I mean, yes, there's beauty, there's craft, there's the score, there's the scenery, et cetera, there's the performances. But like, I think part of why I responded to this differently than I have Martin McDonagh's work in the past is I think the actual question is interesting, and interesting at this kind of moment post-pandemic of a lot of re-examination of relationships and what works and what doesn't, and a lot of people being stuck in their own islands with whoever else happens to live on the island and having to stare them, and by island I mean isolated house, having to stare people in the face and figure out whether you still want to talk to them every day and actually like them. And I'm curious to hear what moral chords the film struck for you with its avenues of inquiry.
I wouldn't say that I side with either one, because I think that would rob the movie of its primal force somehow. What I would say is that, you know, Colm gives him a reason, and, you know, he gives him the reason of, I want to give some gift to posterity, and that's my music. And there's just something eating at him about the time now considered wasted, you know. And not only does he give the reason, the movie then shows you that Colm, as a fiddler and a teacher of music, is flourishing. It's in these little asides, but it's very definite. In fact, at one moment, Park Dana comes in and interrupts him as he's giving this sort of beautiful, you know, Celtic music tutorial to young musicians who are playing along with him. So he's actually making good. He's not just picking up with someone else and having a pint or frittering away his time in some other way. And it certainly ups the stakes of Porrick's inability to see that for what it is, cruel though it may be, and as a friend, respect that choice.
Right, and that choice also, Colm's choice, I mean, to cut off his fingers, the fingers of his left hand, the one that's doing the violin picking, you know, each time that his ex-friend talks to him, you know, this kind of threat that he issues at the beginning of the movie has this kind of O. Henry story quality, right? Where the very thing he claims to want to do with the last 12 years of his life, which is play and teach violin, fiddle to his friends in the pub, can't be done if he follows through with the promise. And that's the place I think that the movie exits identifiable psychology, where you could ask things like, whose side are you on? And goes into this place, you know, this realm of kind of metaphor or fairy tale where, you know, primal resentments are being acted out that don't really have anything to do with each character's best interest, right? I mean, there's a self-destructive negativity in the Brendan Gleeson character that is his kind of tragic weakness. And then there's this, I don't know what you would call the sad, sweet, adorable Colin Farrell character's tragic flaw, but essentially he can't leave well enough alone, right? He can't stop pestering his friend and asking why and trying to fix it somehow. And so to me, and I say this in my review, my identification kept shifting between the two. But I think that again, was all just being skillfully managed by the screenplay and the actors. I don't think it was the case that the movie was wishy-washily not able to decide kind of who was right. And especially if you think about where the movie ends, which we won't spoil, but, you know, there's almost a sense that It's like some Miltonic, you know, battle between the two that can't ever be won on Earth, you know. And in that sense, too, it does become, it's not a heavy-handed allegory for the civil war that's going on at the same time, but in a way, it is about human conflict and the way that, you know, ridiculous means or purposes can turn into tragic outcomes. And I think the movie is so profound about not answering that question exactly.
Yeah, I sympathize with that. And then I also feel the movie does, I think I'm more team Porik. I think I'm team kindness, not team art. I'm laughing because it would be silly to reduce this movie so fruitlessly. And I think actually in the path of the character of the sister Siobhan, you see a way to balance ambition and kindness that does not involve bodily harm. But the fact that the sense that Colin's despair leads him to make this perverse threat, which, you know, if the problem is that his friend can't take his art seriously enough, the notion of levying a threat, which is you will rob me of my ability to do my art, which already it's established that the friend doesn't sufficiently respect, like it's the wrong threat. And it feels like the threat, the kind of mutilatedness of the threat, even before the mutilation, to me suggests like a kind of damage in the rigidity of Colm's, the rigidity of his desire to pursue his art, and the kind of cruelty with which he, and absolutism with which he decides to pursue that, that I'm still puzzling it over. And I totally agree, Dana, everyone should go see it.
Agree. Okay. It's The Banshees of Inisherin, the new movie from Martin McDonagh. It's in the theaters now. One day, of course, it'll be streaming, but maybe check it out sooner rather than later. It's a beautiful looking movie in addition to everything else. All right, let's move on.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on all your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
All right. Now, as typically in the course of the podcast, we discuss business. Dana, what do we have?
Stephen, le business this week is just to tell you about our Slate Plus segment. This week, we're going to talk about a new quarter being issued. I believe it actually comes out this week, that has an unusual face for U.S. currency on it. It's the face of a cultural figure, which in itself is unusual on U.S. currency. It's the face of a woman, which is also unusual. And it's the face of a Chinese American for the first time that an Asian American has appeared on American money. It's Anna May Wong, the silent and sound movie actress who was a big name in her day. We'll talk about that. But she's not somebody at the forefront of the cultural imagination right now. She's an interesting choice for the new series of Women Quarters that the U.S. Mint is coming out with. So we will talk about Anna May Wong, her legacy, and what it means that she's showing up on our money. If you're a Slate Plus member, you can look forward to hearing that segment at the end of this show. And if you're not a Slate Plus member, you can sign up today at slate.com/culture plus. As we mentioned at the top of the show, Slate is having a sale on memberships right now. So you can get 6 months of Slate Plus membership for just $29, which is one half, 50% off the usual price for a membership. Members get ad-free podcasts, bonus content like that Anna May Wong quarter segment I just described, and of course, you get unlimited access to all of the writing on Slate. These memberships really matter a lot to keep the magazine going. So please sign up today at slate.com/culture plus. Once again, that's slate.com/culture plus. Okay, Steve, on with the show.
All right, well, Disney, it's not exactly a name you associate with the horror genre. But then again, if it's in the MCU, it'll be exploited. And lo and behold, there was an a Marvel character from the comic book days, Jack Russell, a.k.a. Werewolf by Night. I think the first one was 1972, maybe. And so he arrives now, inevitably, on the screen. Haha, small screen. Werewolf by Night is on the Streaming Plus platform. It stars Gael Garcia Bernal, summoned to an ancient estate whose patriarch has recently died. He arrives to find four other monster hunters with him. They must fight to the death to see who gains possession of the Bloodstone, a magic gem conferring superpowers and longevity. It also stars Laura Donnelly as the patriarch's estranged and very formidable daughter. In the clip you're about to hear, the title character, the werewolf, is trying to assure his new ally, played by Donnelly, that she shouldn't be too worked up about his condition.
You see, I've got systems to manage the hurt I could cause.
I don't care about your systems. Just stay away from me until you can't.
But they work. You'd be surprised. They actually work. Because I'm not like that. I'm like this. You know, I would never hurt you or hurt anyone. Any hunting that I do is done by a part of me that is not me. And that's not the part you're with right now.
All right, Julia, let me start with you. There's a great semi-maybe hidden fact about this movie. It's directed by an A-list movie composer, Michael Giacchino. How do you think he did?
I love this weird little object. And I did. I hadn't thought of Michael Giacchino as a director. And I do think there is some just kind of attention to the sensation and mood of the moment that feels in keeping with, you know, what composers are doing primarily. But I enjoyed it. And I think the two central performances of Gael Garcia Bernal as Jack Russell and Laura Donnelly as Elsa are really compelling. And I also enjoyed seeing Fraser's agent BB as this like evil convener. And
yes, Harriet Sansom Harris, she kills in that villain role. She's so funny.
She's so fabulous.
There is only one bloodstone, and it can have only one keeper.
So, I don't know, you just say, oh, you're tuning in for the latest Marvel entertainment, and I did not expect, like, an art house jewel box homage to, like, B-movies of yesteryear, but that's what I got. Dana, what did you make of this?
I mean, that is exactly why I've been wanting to do this ever since it premiered on Disney, I don't know, probably a month ago. We finally waited until the week of Halloween, the last possible week of the month of scariness, to talk about this monster movie. But from the minute I saw it, I was sort of like, you had me at Michael Giacchino directing and an homage to Universal, Hammer, you know, old school kind of black and white monster movies. I don't think this completely pulls off the strange thing that it's trying to do, but I will say this, I was trying to figure out the format, because the weirdest thing about it probably is the length, right? Werewolf by Night is 52 minutes long. So it doesn't feel like a TV pilot. It doesn't feel like a movie. It's in this universe, right? The MCU that seems to be begging for teasers and spoilers and Easter eggs and hints about sequels, but it doesn't have any of that stuff. It really is a self-contained hour that I suppose could be spun off, but it completes its own story. And while I was watching it, I was thinking the closest thing I can think of to what this feels like is a Twilight Zone. And then we read an interview with Giacchino, you know, researching for the show. And what did he say? Oh, I was inspired by the Twilight Zone. He was actually thinking of that kind of, you know, sort of golden age TV when he was making it. So that in itself, just the solitary nugget factor, made this kind of endearing. Also, just come on, Gael Garcia Bernal. It was striking me that last week we talked about Diego Luna, right? Another Mexican movie star who co-starred with Gael in the great Y Tu Mamá También over 20 years ago. Now they're both in their own separate, well, one is a series, one's a freestanding standalone show, but you know, they're both kind of doing their Marvel Star Wars thing. And they both bring something from outside into it. You know, it's being a non-American, right? That's one element that they bring from sort of outside. But also both of them just don't quite seem right for a Marvel or Star Wars hero. They're not buff. They're not, you know, big, bulked up macho dudes. There's something sort of delicate and beautiful about each of them. And they're both perfect in those roles and really kind of make the show. So Gael is a werewolf, yes. Standaloneness, yes. Does everything work in it? Not completely. I mean, for a 52-minute show, this has a lot of Marvel-style fight scenes in it. And frankly, I was tuning out during them, and that felt a little bit like, not quite fan service, but, you know, a studio service. Like, this couldn't brand itself as a Marvel show unless it had, you know, the requisite 50 times that a guy is getting punched out and his hand is cut off and his hand is then used to fire a weapon at someone else, you know, kind of stuff. It's done fairly well and briskly, but I do wish that Giacchino had a little bit more time to dig into who the werewolf was. Maybe had him transform more than one time into a werewolf, because that scene is great. I don't want to give away how it's shown, but there's a lot of practical effects in when the werewolf transforms for the first and only time. And that in itself, the fact that there's not CGI or not a a lot of CGI in that scene, and that there's indirection, you know, like showing a shadow on the wall that's used instead of showing a digital transformation of his body. It's just really fun and sweet. And you don't have to love horror to like this, because it's not particularly scary. You could watch it with a 10 or 11 year old kid probably. But yeah, I'm all in. I would do more of these standalones, and I would see more from Michael Giacchino.
Yeah, I loved everything about it that cut against the, you know, basic, you know, MCU imperatives. As you say, Dana, it's like the standalone is totally anomalous within that business model. You're always teasing, setting up, or calling back and milking nostalgia, you know. And this does really kind of neither. I love Bernal and Donnelly are both terrific. They have chemistry in the leads. And Harriet Sampson Harris is kind of a revelation. Her voice work alone is hysterically funny. And, you know, just like grand guignol or whatever the expression is, she almost, you know, kind of makes it, you know, in the sense that she's the person who sets the whole thing up in the plot, but also throws all of its, you know, preposterous spookiness over the whole project. That, and also just the look and feel of it. I mean, I knew nothing about, you know, Giacchino as a director, but he's very sure-handed. And the, you know, obviously the largest choice is filming in black and white in this throwback vintage way. It reminds me of sitting at home on the carpet in front of an old console TV and watching like Bride of Frankenstein or something. And the one source of color in it is the gemstone, which is, you know, a nice little touch. The one thing I'll say, Julia, though, is that at the end of the day, Marvel can't help itself, right? At the end of the day, there's a talismanic object that confers superpowers that everyone's fighting over, and a protracted fist fight is what determines possession of it. And you go back to this like extremely crude, reductive template, and it's everything else is so good it doesn't ruin it by any means, but it's boring.
Yeah, I mean, I think my challenge was less that it was trying to fit into the Marvel universe and more that I'm not a fan of that old school universal. Like, I don't know what you're supposed to get out of those exactly. Not to sound too transactional about it, but I appreciated the lightness of tone here, and that it sort of, the stakes felt very low in a way that was that worked for me. Like, typically the stakes in a Marvel movie are all of civilization is about to be vaporized, right? And yet the way in which it is about to be vaporized is so CGI'd and full of like grayscale garbage that you don't actually care about the vaporization. You know, it's like represented by like one hunk's earthbound girlfriend or something. And in this instance, the stakes are like MacGuffinishly low, like who will possess the blood red ruby? Who, you know, it's like, I don't know, who cares? And I don't know, it like leaned into the skid, right? Like it just felt like it was aware of its own significance in the world in a way that was at mm-hmm. odds with the general grandiosity and pomposity of Marvel blather. I don't know. I mean, I do think we're at a moment in Hollywood with the sort of consolidation and financial pressures coming to all of these streamers where kind of beautiful, weird little furbelows like this are just going to get squashed. I'm sorry to say. Like, I just think the appetite for making irrational things to stuff out your streaming roster is going to start getting pinched. So I don't know that we're going to get 20 more of these. I assume that Gael will be back to do something else in this character at some point. And there seemed to be a lot of fan love for the man thing. Oh God, I got to remember the name of the man thing. But Ted. Anyway, the monster. There's another monster.
I think his actual name is Man Thing in the comics, at least. Okay. Although he's never called that in this show.
Man Thing by day. Anyway, you know, I can't wait for the buddy comedy between Werewolf by Night and Man Thing by Day, which surely this is setting up. But I did.
the Banshees of Inisherin has nothing on werewolf and man thing.
But is the man thing, by the man thing, do you mean Ted, the sidekick monster?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes. Wait,
Julia, he has a name. Ted. All right. Well, it's sort of a genuinely lighthearted fun. And you should check it out. It's great. It's on Disney Plus, and it's a little Halloween treat. All right, moving on.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Hey, listeners, whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance, too. Enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance. Then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget, giving you options. Now, that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you fast. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at Progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
All right. Well, the writer John Brandon in Forbes has written an article called Gen Z Have Canceled the Thumbs Up Emoji and Here's Why You Should Worry. Julia, that's a crazy, silly headline, teaser headline. And of course, you know, the New York Post, a Murdoch rag, is hyping the idea that there's a generational battle, that emojis are being canceled. But I think effectively, if I'm correct, what we're talking about when, for example, young colleagues of boomer, you know, employers find their use of a thumbs up emoji too abrupt or the heart emoji somehow comically anachronistic or inappropriate, is there are nuances and subtleties to online communication that only someone who grew up almost entirely in the age of social media will come to understand, and they get established organically and laterally among peers, as I know, witnessing my children and the way they make fun of my usage. Is that what's going on here, a kind of micro-generational battle that's relatively harmless being hyped by journalists, or is something larger and more ominous going on here?
Well, there were two primary texts we were looking at for this piece, right? The main one is Gen Z is canceling the thumbs up emoji and why you should worry, or whatever that headline is, which is truly just a gem of headline writing. And that one is from the perspective of, I think, a Gen X or boomer who's like, I just figured out emoji and now I'm told they're not cool. And is I think on Forbes, and is truly just like a worthless piece of interneting apart from the headline. Like, who cares about your emoji use, dude? But Dana also flagged for us in the course of our research a piece in The Atlantic called The GIF is on Its Deathbed, noting that this, you know, very popular style of kind of early teens communication of responding with reaction GIFs or selecting and clipping the exact right couple of frames of response and popping them into a Slack or a chat or a group chat felt like a beautiful way to communicate for a while. That may be ending for various reasons and no longer seems cool. And each of them is a different example with differing levels of erudition of a similar piece, which is like a generational cri de coeur of like, I thought I knew how to communicate and the next generation says I'm lame. And I think there's even more pathos to the millennial, the Atlantic piece, which is written by a self-avowed millennial who is, I think, having that generational experience of newly lamenting being superseded by the next generation. We older types have been superseded several times over now, and so I'm very comfortable with using lame modes of communication. I've got no problem with that. But the sort of particular pathos of the millennial generation, which felt like it owned the internet for so long because it was the first generation to truly grow up natively online, I think seems like it's really wrestling with the fact that the internet changes every, you know, 18 months. And the next generation of internet users is sneering at a couple of interneting ticks. So I think what we're seeing here is not technological change or a massive shift in modes of communication, but the fact that slang and habits of chit-chat evolve, and inevitably part of the point of their evolution is for the youngest among us to find ways to feel new and fresh and to articulate their particular realities, and for we older types to, you know, struggle to keep up and have our own feelings about our impending deaths, prompted by the death of the GIF, for example. So it's all about mortality, but it's fine, is my conclusion.
Somehow Julia managed to turn a couple of trashy articles, zeitgeist hustling articles, into Old Testament allegory, but you get off of Inishir, lass. But Dana, am I wrong to see something, if not ominous, certainly meaningful here, which is that what there is actually a serious conflict, very like deeply serious conflict, between generations about what the sort of general framework and ethos of communication etiquette should be. And it can be spun by right wingers as trivial and, you know, even juvenile and overly demanding and like morally sensitive to a degree that gives being moral a bad name. It can be spun by, you know, people on the left as an utterly necessary change as we move away from, you know, white, older white men, boomer men, as the default leaders and owners of public spaces and public speech. You know, I guess we have to take it on a case by case basis, but you know, as soon as you translate these debates from my kids make fun of me for using the heart emoji or thinking LOL meant lots of love into the workplace, you know, any kind of official or semi-official mode of communication on a campus, for example, all of a sudden it's a hugely consequential debate. No,
I guess. I mean, I'm not sure that it's being in this particular circumstance.
I'm
not sure you can
tried.
Make that argument, because, like, are people being offended? I don't think that this argument about who's old and who should use what emoji, which I think is ultimately completely silly. Like I've said many times on this show, that all the kind of like mediatized generational warfare that's constantly being staged seems completely unreal to me.
Yes.
Like it doesn't really affect most people's lives that much, and most divisions that, you know, group people come along the dividing line of, you know, politics or you know, ethnic identity or gender identity or class, all kinds of things that have nothing to do with what generation you're in and what your emoji usage means about that. So, I mean, insofar as I think this is an interesting topic for us to talk about it, I'm glad that we're taking on this topic. I think it's to sort of put into question the faux ominousness of the second half of that headline with here's how why you should be worried. You know, I mean, what is the greatest thing that the author of that article seems to fear, or that the, you know, the people offended by their younger counterparts criticizing their emoji usage fear? They fear being thought of as old. Like, who cares? Compared to what? You know, I mean, it also seems to me that when I think about how emojis are used by lots of people I know, and we've had a whole segment before on this show once, I think at a live show, we talked about emojis in a different context, just our own personal usage of them. And it struck me, including with the response to that piece from listeners, how creatively and differently different people use them in ways that have nothing to do with their generation, right? I mean, there's the ironic usage of things, but there's also, I think I talked about this at the time, like a friend of mine who's roughly my generation who makes rebuses out of her emojis and will send entire lists, groups of emojis that you have to sort of like put together like a puzzle for fun, you know, or draw faces with them or something. You know, I think I mentioned that in my family, each of us has an emoji that represents us. So, you know, we can send that as part of a conversation about what we're doing. I mean, there's a playfulness. That's why people enjoy using them, right? They're little cartoons that sort of make communication, digital communication, a little bit more playful. And I just don't think, I don't really care what some group of people is arguing about what generation uses them in what way. I mean, another example of this, I guess, would be the GIF, you know, whether GIFs are really corny to use or not. I use GIFs all the time because I'm a film critic and I'm often talking to other film critics online. And it's fun and playful if you're talking about movies to go back and forth posting little moments from those movies. It's an integral part of the conversation, you know? So in that sense, like, the picture is doing something that words couldn't do. I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm missing the point of this conversation, but I could not shrug more about what people think my usage of anything means. And in fact, I designed a Bitmoji for myself. You know, those characters you can design where you go through and make them sort of look like you. And I always thought Bitmojis were completely silly and corny, but I painstakingly designed one that looked as much like me as possible just to torment my daughter, who I guess is Gen Z, you know, about the corniness of it. So whenever she'll text me something, I send her back some ridiculous Bitmoji of myself, like riding on a rocket ship covered with hearts or something like that, just to make her laugh. You know,
I also send people Bitmojis for their birthdays, and they are definitely uncool, and that's the point. It's so kind of fun. I mean, I guess there's just this sort of hysteria of like, oh no, it's the internet, I don't know how to use it. It's like, people don't know how to use language. Like, miscommunication happens with all of the mediums of communication, and people make language choices that reflect their like age and upbringing, and thus it will ever be. And like, yeah, just don't freak out about it. Like, what the absolute lack of consequence in all of this is.
So you say, I'm like, I feel like I'm trying to inflate a gigantic pool floaty out of this topic, right? And it kind of is in the shape of and looks like an anvil, but even at the end of the day, when I get this like 14-foot tall thing inflated, I'll just be exhausted and it's still just a bunch of hot air, right? Like,
Wait, a pool floaty shaped like an anvil.
Like, it's still going to bob
along. The episode title that never was.
It's going to bob along harmlessly on the surface of the water. You don't try blacksmithing on it. But the one thing I would say is that there are these internally generated nuances that got immediately added to the pre-existing store of like GIFs and emojis or whatever, and like, you know, little acronyms or whatever you want to call them, little abbreviations. That one reason I think young people resorted to them is they're just in a constant game of evasion to not be their elders, as they always have been and should be. And so all of a sudden, like, you know, certain things take on an importance that older people don't understand. And so you're bound to keep on making this generational gaffe to the extent that you communicate with like my kids or whatever. And they're fine. They love making fun of me. But, you know, I do think that there is an ongoing, highly consequential debate about what rules govern, like unwritten rules by and large, govern public semi-official discourse, especially in the workplace and campuses. And so when there is this friction between generations, you can get into something serious. And the final thing I'd say, and this to me is what I really believe, this isn't the pool floaty, this is the actual substance of it, is that there's just this graceless way in which the baby boomers will not exit the stage literally until the fucking scythe of the reaper, you know, comes and gets them. And that's where I land with this. It's sort of just try to grow old with an ounce of grace and self-consciousness.
But Steve, if I can once again insert my complete skepticism about this whole generational series of divides we're supposed to be arguing about, aren't you part of the baby boom technically? I mean, wouldn't you have been born in the late years of what's called the baby boom? And I would agree that you don't seem culturally identified with the signifiers of that generation, but couldn't somebody point at you and say, okay, boomer, right now?
Of course, I would expect them to. They do and should. I have no problem with that. I mean, the one thing I would say is I'm absolutely 100% on a cusp, as demonstrated by the fact that half of the, you know, demographers say that I'm Gen X and half say that I'm baby boomers. I'm literally at that moment where you're sort of neither one. And I will say one of the quirks of my life is that someone 3 years older than me feels like they are a member of a completely distinct generation from me, and someone 3 years younger does as well. And I think that that's somewhat curious, right? Like I definitely note it repeatedly in my own experience.
All right. Well, in conclusion, everybody communicate however you want.
All right, that is bound to go smoothly. Let me read that preposterous title one more time. Gen Z have canceled the thumbs up emoji, and here's why you should worry. It's in Forbes.
Here's why you should worry. Grab the bloodstone.
Your spooky voice is terrific, man. It's sad.
It's spooky season,
only
man.
Once a year. Yeah, it sure is. All right, yeah. Let's move on.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
All right, well, now is the moment in the podcast when we endorse Dana. What do you have?
Stephen, I'm going to endorse the movie that made me stay up way too late last night. I was tuning in to watch Werewolf by Night, the one-hour Marvel special that we talked about. And when I turned on the TV, TCM happened to be on, and the 1962 horror film Carnival of Souls happened to be just about to begin. So I just fell into the hole. And even though I've seen this movie several times, I mean, it's almost Halloween. I had to watch it again. Do either of you know this low-budget horror movie from 1962, Carnival of Souls?
No.
Black and white.
I do not.
No? All right. Well, no. I'm afraid that many people listening, if you're a cult horror person, you probably know this movie already. I would not classify myself as a cult horror person. I don't seek out horror movies just because I want to have that sensation. But when the right one comes along, I completely get why that sensation is pleasurable. And if you enjoy that sensation, you can have it watching Carnival of Souls, one of the weirdest horror movies I can think of. So Carnival of Souls is a very low-budget movie. It was produced and directed by a guy named Herc Harvey, making his only feature-length movie. And it just has this feeling of sort of creepy rightness, where even though all the choices, almost every choice in it seems to have been made because the budget was only $33,000. At the same time, every one of those choices works incredibly. And it's got so much artfulness in it, given how low that budget actually is. And I don't want to give up too much about it, except to say that it's about a young woman who has a car crash and afterwards starts to have all kinds of very strange experiences that you don't know if they mean she's gone crazy. You don't know if they mean she's in the afterlife or if she's just in a supernatural world. But, well, Julia, one of your least favorite movie tropes, an abandoned carnival is involved in Carnival of Souls.
No, I will never watch this. God damn it.
And the whole thing has just this very culty feeling that has been cited as sort of like early David Lynch, You know, it has a little bit in common with sort of slasher movies, but it's not extremely gory. It's much more moody. There is a lot of organ music in it because this young woman happens to be a church organist for a living, always a good job to have if you're going to be the heroine of a horror movie. All I can say is that it gives you this feeling of creepy unsettledness throughout and images that you'll never forget, even while you can't quite say that the plot makes complete sense. Anyway, it's all vibes. It's Carnival of Souls from 1962, and it's not hard to find streaming on any platform. I know that it's on TCM right now this month.
Oh, that is marvelous. Julia, what do you have?
That's a sensational endorsement for something I will never watch. So there's this singer-songwriter. I've been a fan of hers for a while. Not sure everybody's really aware of her, but she's got a new album out, and I really think it's worth a listen. It is called Midnights, and the singer's name is Taylor Swift. And I just, really think people should give her a chance. You know, she's like an artist. She's got really interesting things to say about the world in her voice, using her authorship, and it's time to reconnect with Tay. I'm just trolling Steve, but I do really like Taylor's new album. I mean, I think it's sort of halfway between pop Taylor and folky Taylor, and I am still listening, and it remains to be seen whether there are epic bops for time immemorial on this. There's a particular song called Anti-Hero, which is just the apotheosis of everything that's irritating about her shtick of like kind of everybody hates me-ism that is understandably irritating to many, and yet the song is so good and has a very funny chorus and it's super catchy, and I was singing it all last night. It's me. Anyway, Taylor Swift, Midnights, check out the song Anti-Hero, and enjoy.
You know, Julia.
Yeah, Steve.
You had to administer a little bit of gratuitous Halloween poison to taint the whole show and bring me within an inch of the grave. But as the rigor mortis, as the rigor mortis rises up, chilling my body with premonitions of a blank afterlife, I have the antidote right here.
Okay.
Because I too am endorsing a singer-songwriter who's actually good, and it comes to us from a surprising place, which is you. Everyone knows the band from the 60s, The Zombies, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? What's your name? Who's your daddy? Is he rich like me? They had a couple of huge hits. To take you in the sun, to promise lands, to show you everyone. It's the time of the season for love. Sort of a somewhat star-crossed career. They broke up right before their best record broke and became hugely popular, on and on and on. Well, it turns out, I didn't know this, a friend of mine told me this past week, and well, you know that the lead singer of The Zombies, Colin Blunstone, made like a masterpiece of a solo record, kind of in the Nick Drake singer-songwriter, mopey, you know, really deep English Celtic folky vein, and it's a record is called 1 Year. I think it's from 71 or 2, and these songs are extraordinary. I mean, it is regarded as a masterpiece, and it's just a tremendous, like, beautiful contemplative. It's like all of what's really uniquely bewitching about The Zombies, but just sort of sent in a very different direction with, string arrangements and finger-picking guitar. And then his vocals are so precise and sort of unexpectedly baroque without being show-offy. I mean, there's just wonderful melodic swoops to it that are just great. I love it. It's just a tremendous record. I cannot believe that the vault like got shaken one more time and some beautiful, beautiful gemstone fell out of it and saved my life this Halloween from the poison of poptimism and spite, which is Julia Turner. All right, so it's Colin Blunstone, B-L-U-N-S-T-O-N-E, Colin Blunstone. He, the lead singer of The Zombies, his solo record from the early 70s, 1 year. Check it out.
I feel like if we've learned anything from this episode, it's that we should record like a Universal-style spooky season radio play. I feel like we all have good spooky voices that were like unbeknownst to me, low these 15-odd years of taping this show. So Vince and Bryce, watch your back.
I love it.
Next Halloween, all spook edition.
Yeah, absolutely.
Get your zithers out.
You will find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page. That's slate.com/culturefest. And you can email us at culturefest@slate.com. Please do. We love it. Our introductory music is by the composer Nicholas Patel. Our production assistant is Jessica Balderrama. Our producer is Cameron Drews. For Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. We will see you soon.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.